Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast, which is brought to you by Medicom Medical Publisher. Today I will discuss six of the presentations that were held at the annual meeting of the American Heart Association, which was held in Chicago, Illinois, from the 5th through the 7th of November. Enjoy listening and have a great day. So the first study I would like to talk about is a phase 3 TRANSFORM-HF trial, which compared torsemide to furosemide in hospitalized patients with heart failure. The pragmatic randomized phase 3 TRANSFORM-HF trial was designed to compare long-term clinical outcomes of treatment strategies with furosemide versus torsemide in patients with HF needing hospital admission. We focused on the recruitment of hospitalized patients with HF broad eligibility criteria that included patients regardless of ejection fraction, as long as there was a long-term plan for a loop diuretic. Professor Robert Mentz of the Duke University Hospital in North Carolina, USA, explained, "The open-label dosing regimens were left at the discretion of the treating clinician. Follow-up was performed without in-person study visits at 30 days, 6 and 12 months. The primary endpoint was defined as all-cause mortality. Despite the pandemic, TRANSFORM-HF was able to randomize 2,859 patients enrolled between 2019 and 2022 in a one-to-one fashion. Baseline characteristics showed well-balanced and diverse groups with a mean age of 65 years, about 37% women, and 34% self-identified as black. Around 64% had a reduced ejection fraction of less than 40%, and among those, over 80% received treatment with beta blockers and more than two-thirds received medication influencing the renin-angiotensin system. Upon trial entry, 67% of participants were already treated with a loop diuretic, the great majority receiving furosemide. At baseline, the total daily dose was equivalent to 66 mg of furosemide in both groups. After discharge, the furosemide equivalent dosage in both arms was about 80 mg. The result for all-cause mortality showed high event rates in both treatment arms with 374 or 26.2% on furosemide and 373 or 26.1% on torsemide. This translated into 17 events per 100 patient years in both arms and a non-significant hazard ratio of 1.02. In terms of the composite secondary endpoint of all-cause mortality or hospitalizations, the findings were very similar, 49.3% and 107.6 events per 100 patient years in the furosemide group versus 47.3% and 99.2 events per 100 patient years in the torsemide arm, leading to an HR of 0.92. Furthermore, the event rates in total hospitalization at 12 months did also not differ significantly, as did the results of a pre-specified on-treatment analysis. Interestingly, the on-treatment analysis also uncovered that a crossover from furosemide to torsemide or vice versa at discharge was present in 5.4%, while 2.8% did not have a loop diuretic at all. After 30 days, these percentages rose to 6.7% of crossover participants and 7.0% of participants without a loop diuretic. Professor Mentz stressed that insights from the pragmatic trial design and execution could inform future studies aiming to assess real-world effectiveness in diverse populations. Next, I would like to discuss some results of the phase 3 EMPA-KIDNEY trial, which assessed empagliflozin in patients with chronic kidney disease, and the results were discussed by Professor David Price of the University of Oxford. Professor Price presented prominent data from the EMPA-KIDNEY trial, as well as a meta-analysis on the effect of sodium glucose cotransporter 2 inhibition. EMPA-KIDNEY assessed 6,609 patients with chronic kidney disease at risk of its progression for the primary composite outcome of cardiovascular death or kidney disease progression when treated either with placebo or 10 mg of empagliflozin once daily. The median follow-up time was 2 years. At baseline, The mean age was 64 years, about one-third were women, and the mean eGFR was 37 milliliters per minute per 1.73 square meters. We intended to recruit many patients without diabetes, Professor Price elaborated, resulting in 46% of participants with diabetic comorbidity. A primary outcome event happened significantly less often on empagliflozin than on placebo, with 30.1% versus 16.9%. A p-value below 0.001. This corresponded to a hazard ratio of 0.72. Similar differences were also found when stratifying according to prior vascular disease. Professor Price emphasized that the effect was mainly driven by the renal component of the primary outcome. The number of cardiovascular deaths, 128 out of 990 events, was smaller than expected, he said. To continue, all-cause hospitalization was significantly reduced by 14% through treatment with the study drug, and this was consistent across subgroups according to, for example, diabetes status and eGFR. The analysis of recurrent cardiovascular events, such as heart failure hospitalization, major adverse cardiovascular events, and cardiovascular death, all showed a clear but non-significant trend for a reduction with empagliflozin. According to Professor Price, the lack of significance was likely due to underpowering of the study regarding cardiovascular outcomes. To shed further light on the efficacy of SGLT2 inhibitors, Professor Price also revealed results from a collaborative meta-analysis of 13 large SGLT2 inhibitor trials. Over 90,000 participants were available for these analyses. 80% had diabetes, Professor Price stated, underlining that this still meant a substantial part of patients did not have diabetes. Cardiovascular outcomes demonstrated an overall significant reduction of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization by 23%. Stratification into patients with and without diabetes led to consistent results in both subgroups. As for cardiovascular death alone, SGLT2 inhibitor prompted a decrease of 14% overall with a relative risk of 0.86 for diabetic and a relative risk of 0.88 for non-diabetic patients. Our results suggest that SGLT2 inhibitors such as empagliflozin should be offered to all adults who may benefit from the treatment to reduce the risk of kidney disease progression and cardiovascular complications in people with chronic kidney disease, regardless of whether they have type 2 diabetes, Professor Price expressed. Some other interesting results came from the phase 2 OCEAN dose trial, which tested the small interfering RNA molecule olpasiran in patients with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. According to a previously published register study in a predominantly European population, concentrations of lipoprotein A, or LPA, are associated with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, or ASCVD. About 20% of patients with pre-existing ASCVD had a high LPA concentration, above 150 nanomole per liter, that was associated with a high and independent risk for cardiovascular events. Olpasiran is a small interfering RNA molecule designed to lower the body's production of apolipoprotein A, a key component of LPA. Professor Michel O'Donoghue presented the results of the double-blind placebo-controlled treatment period of the phase 2 OCEAN dose clinical study evaluating olpasiran in 281 adult patients with LPA levels over 150 nanomole per liter and evidence of ASCVD. Olpasiran was administered in 4 different doses, up to 225 mg subcutaneously every 12 weeks to patients with a median baseline LPA of approximately 260 nanomoles per liter. The primary endpoint was the percentage change in LPA from baseline to week 36 compared with placebo. The study included 34 sites in 7 countries all over the world. At week 36, therapy with olpasiran led to a significant reduction of LPA that was over 95% in the highest 2 dose groups. The primary endpoint was met, with a 70.5% change in the 10 mg dose group and over 90% in all other dose groups. Moreover, a high percentage of patients achieved LPA concentrations below 125 nanomoles per liter. This is an established threshold of risk. Virtually all patients achieved a value below this threshold, Professor O'Donoghue emphasized. The treatment effect was independent of age, sex, race, region, baseline LPA, baseline LDL cholesterol, and high-potency lipid-lowering therapy. You can appreciate there was no evidence of effect modification across any of these pre-specified subgroups, Professor O'Donoghue said. Therapy with olpasiran also lowered LDL cholesterol. Overall, the agent was well tolerated with an increased occurrence of injection site reactions and related hypersensitivity reactions. However, these were described as mild in severity and resolved without treatment. When it comes to aortic bypass grafting to the left anterior descending artery, the use of the internal thoracic artery is a long accepted primary choice. But the conduit for the second most important target vessel remains unclear, Professor David Hare stated. The REPCO program consisted of two separate integrated trials that compared the use of the radial artery versus the free right internal thoracic artery, or RITA. In the REPCO RITA trial and the radial artery versus a saphenous vein graft in the REPCO SVG trial, Professor Hare presented the 15-year clinical REPCO outcomes. REPCO RITA included patients under 70 years of age or under 60 years if they were diabetic. The trial randomized 394 participants to radial artery or free RITA grafting. The baseline data showed a mean age of about 59 years, around 10% were women, and 11% had diabetes. The composite clinical outcome of MACE consisted of all-cause mortality, acute myocardial infarction, and/or repeated coronary revascularization. The use of radial artery versus RITA resulted in a significant difference in favor of radial artery with a hazard ratio of 0.74 and a p-value of 0.04. Looking at components of the primary outcome, you can see that the principal driver of MACE was probably all-cause mortality, which had an absolute risk reduction of 8% after 15 years and a relative risk reduction of 31%, Professor Hare elaborated. In REPCO SVG, 225 participants were included, and in line with the somewhat different inclusion criteria, the mean age was around 73 years, 19% were women, and 45% had diabetes. After allocation to grafting with either radial artery or saphenous vein, the outcomes of MACE were also significantly advantageous for radial artery over SVG, with a hazard ratio of 0.71 and a p-value of 0.04 at 15 years. Professor Hare mentioned that of the currently around 200,000 coronary artery bypass surgeries performed yearly in the US, less than 10% of patients receive radial artery grafts. Due to the results obtained through REPCO, he suggested that all isolated CAGB operations should consider using a radial graft if it is suitable and without contraindications. We can't assume that's true of instrumented radial arteries. It might be true, but I think we need further research on that, Professor Hare concluded. Next, I would like to talk about an interesting study that compared rosuvastatin with various dietary supplements for the reduction of LDL cholesterol. The genesis of the study is that we all see patients that have their medication list littered with dietary supplements. And when you delve deeper into the data, over 3/4 of Americans take a dietary supplement. 18% of those individuals take a supplement to promote heart health, Dr. Luke Laffin explained. So the SPORT trial was set up to evaluate a low-dose statin treatment of 5 mg rosuvastatin on lipids and inflammatory biomarkers to placebo and 6 widely used dietary supplements: fish oil, cinnamon, garlic, turmeric, plant sterols, or red yeast rice. Within the prospective randomized single-blinded trial, 199 participants were equally allocated to one of the 8 study arms. Laboratory testing that included a lipid and a comprehensive metabolic panel, as well as high-sensitive CRP, was performed at day 0 and 28 of the SPORT trial. Primary endpoint was a proportion of change in LDL cholesterol. Study participants were in their mid-60s, we enrolled 60% of patients, and the mean LDL cholesterol was 128 mg per deciliter, and most people had relatively normal or low CRP, Dr. Laffin described the SPORT cohort. Results of the percent change in LDL cholesterol showed superior efficacy of rosuvastatin with a 37.86% reduction versus placebo and all supplements, with a p-value below 0.001 for all comparisons. Results for change in total cholesterol and triglycerides were similarly superior for all evaluations. High-sensitive CRP did not differ between the statin arm and the other groups. None of the supplements actually decreased LDL cholesterol compared to placebo, and in fact, the garlic supplement increased LDL cholesterol by almost 8%. Dr. Laffin commented on the values for biomarker results of the supplement arms versus the placebo group. Beside the significant increase of LDL cholesterol in the garlic arm, however, plant sterols decreased HDL cholesterol versus placebo with 7.1%. The comparisons did not yield significant results for change in total cholesterol, triglycerides, or high-sensitive CRP. Adverse events were numerically similar across all study groups, and in fights slightly higher with some of the supplements, particularly plant sterols and red yeast rice, Dr. Levin indicated, especially mentioning that no musculoskeletal events were reported in the rosuvastatin arm. We really should use these results to have evidence-based discussions with patients about the benefits of low-dose statin and the lack of benefit that we see for these heart health supplements. Dr. Levin reviewed the public health importance of the trial. Finally, there was an interesting study on aprocitentan, which is an endothelin receptor antagonist, and this was tested in the phase 3 precision trial as a hypertensive agent. The phase 3 precision study investigated endothelin receptor antagonist aprocitentan as treatment option for patients with resistant hypertension. The study consisted of three parts: a 4-week double-blind part with randomization to either placebo or aprocitentan, 12.5 mg or 25 mg, a consecutive single-blind sections with 32 weeks of 25 mg aprocitentan for all 730 participants, and finally, a withdrawal segment with re-randomization to either placebo or 25 mg of the study drug over 12 weeks. The primary endpoint compared mean systolic office blood pressure on aprocitentan with placebo at the end of part 1. Key secondary endpoint looked at the blood pressure change after the first 4 weeks of the withdrawal phase, or at week 40. In terms of the study population properties, Professor Marcus Schleich of the University of Western Australia in Perth pointed out that it reflected a truly high-risk population, with a mean age around 62, 60% were men, and over 60% had at least 4 baseline antihypertensives. About 20% had heart failure, and more than half had diabetes. With both doses of aprocitentan, there was a clinically meaningful and significant blood pressure reduction of around 15.3 millimeters mercury. And this is significantly more pronounced than the effect with placebo, thereby meeting the primary endpoint, Professor Schleich revealed, referring to a p-value of 0.0042 for aprocitentan 12.5 mg and a p-value of 0.0046 for aprocitentan 25 mg versus placebo. Over part 2 of the trial, the lower blood pressure results were maintained in all patients. At week 40 or week 4 of withdrawal, office systolic blood pressure again differed significantly between the aprocitentan and the placebo arm. Importantly, very similar results were seen for diastolic blood pressure, Professor Schleich added. The ambulatory blood pressure results were also significantly in favor of both study drug doses. Edema or fluid retention, as expected, was the most common adverse event, usually occurring in the first 4 weeks, and they were easily clinically managed with additional diuretic therapy, Professor Schleich stated. This side effect led to treatment discontinuation in a total of 7 patients. I would propose that dual endothelin antagonism with aprocitentan may represent a new alternative pharmacological approach to treat resistant hypertension, concluded Professor Schleich.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.